Pauline Osaroff and Natalie Mandelblatt are interviewing Rabbi Bernard Pupko on July 26, 1976. Oral History 2, Council of Jewish Women.
Thank you, Natalie. Rabbi, we're very happy that you are agreeing to give us the benefit of your very exciting background, which I think is well known in the Jewish community of Pittsburgh. Would you tell us about your immediate family? We have as much time as you need, and I know that you have many exciting generations of people that you will tell us about, and anything that you would like to tell us, we'll be very happy to hear.
I was born in the Soviet Union, and my father, Rabbi Eliezer Pupko, was the chief rabbi of the historic Jewish community of Bielizh in White Russia. I say historic because the first blood libel accusation against Jews in Tsarist Russia took place in our community in the year 1823, when the entire Jewish community was arrested. They were kept in a prison camp for some 3 or 4 years, and they were accused of murdering a Christian boy to use his blood for the Pesach matzah. And therefore, the city is known in history.
Could you spell the name of that place?
Yeah. It is spelled B-E-L-I-Z, Beliz. It is in the neighborhood of Minsk. Minsk and Vitebsk. Vitebsk, the city of Chagall. Actually, it is 80 miles away from Vitebsk, where Chagall was born and where he started his artistic work. Mm. Now, my father was several times arrested by the Soviet government because they intercepted letters of his which were sent to rabbinic leaders in the United States, in England, and in Israel, which was then Palestine, describing to them the precarious condition of Jewish life during the Stalin era, when they closed up all of the religious educational facilities, and when they desecrated many, many synagogues, and arrested and executed many rabbis and other religious functionaries. But then there was also a trial against my father in Soviet Russia, and this was in 1930. And he was convicted and given 2 years of hard labor in Siberia. As a result of the very vigorous intercession of Jewish leaders in the United States and in Europe, the sentence was removed, and he was ordered to remain under home arrest, which means he could not leave the city where we live. He could not travel beyond it. And then, of course, my father did not give up the hope of getting out of Russia, because there were several reasons for it. First of all, three oldest brothers, one was 13, and one 11, and one 9, were virtually smuggled across the boundary lines between Soviet Russia and Poland. And this was in 1925. So that they could learn in a yeshiva. There were no yeshivas in Russia. And my parents paid a man whose occupation was in Minsk to smuggle over people across the boundary lines, which was very dangerous, because whoever was caught, they were shot immediately. There was no trial. They paid them an enormous sum in golden rubles, they took those boys across, and we did not hear from them for over 2 years. We did not know whether they're dead or alive. And obviously, there was a desire to see what happened with those boys, to see them in Poland. We knew already that they were alive. We knew exactly where they were. So there was a tremendous maternal temptation to get out of the Soviet Union and be able to see the three oldest boys. We, in our family, we were six boys and two girls, and there was a time in the United States when we were the only six ordained rabbis of any family, six brothers ordained rabbis, because eventually all of us reached the United States. It would be a long story to tell how unexpectedly and how totally unbelievable my parents did manage to get out of the Soviet Union in 1932. It's a story by itself, a very long story. It was totally unexpected. All I can say is that not all of us left our city at the same time. My father was disguised as a Russian peasant because he could not leave town. He was like under arrest. And he left in the middle of the night 3 days before, and then my mother woke us up about 2 o'clock in the morning. She told us not to say a word, not to take anything. We left over a house with about 14 rooms, all of our possessions, and we went to the river. And there my mother engaged a peasant with a small boat, a boat which he had to row. And we went over 130 miles on the water, and we were still afraid if we would have been caught, it would have been death, at least for the adults of the family. And disguised and in secrecy, we reached a railroad. And then we came to the boundary line, Siebierz, between Soviet Russia and Latvia. But we did have passports. And Dr. Rosen, the late Dr. Rosen of the United States, who was the head of the Joint Distribution Committee, JDC, in Russia, was a luminous personality. He was in no small measure responsible for making it possible for my parents to get the passports to leave the Soviet Union. And he kept it so that they could not be confiscated, because the JDC then in Moscow enjoyed diplomatic immunity, like a foreign office. In fact, the communists were happy with the JDC because they brought over hundreds of American tractors, not only for Birobidzhan, that which was supposed to have been the Jewish Autonomous Republic, but they gave it also to the collective farms, many of these tractors, and thus teaching the Russians some of the modern ways of agrarian methods, farming, as it was practiced in the United States. So Rosen, although it was the black era of Stalin, he enjoyed special status. He was a very intimate and close friend of my late father, and he played a very important role in it. Incidentally, it should be mentioned that Dr. Rosen was an internationally known expert on farming, on agrarian science, and of course we cannot forget this name, who was so much helpful to us. In fact, to the moment, from the time we left our home in middle of the night until we reached the train which was supposed to take us from Russia across the border to Latvia, it was about 3 days, and we were all in fear. Anytime if we would have been apprehended, it would have been our end, and so forth. And finally, we made it in Latvia. We were the only people traveling in a train with about 17 wagons. This is how few people were able to get out then from the Soviet Union. We were unusually lucky. It was some kind of a miracle, whatever it might have been. And to make a long story short, we were reunited with our brothers, my parents' oldest three children, in Warsaw, Poland. We went from Latvia to Poland, and of course they did not want to let us in Poland, because Poland had a law that anyone coming from Russia could not come into Poland. The Pilsudski did not want to have anything of communism or anything of former citizens. So special legislation, because of the prominence of my father, was passed in the Sejm, which is the parliament of the Poles, and they permitted us to come in for several months in Poland, just on a temporary visit, and there the family was reunited. And from there, the family continued. My father was invited to a rabbinical position in St. Louis. But there, the climate was not the best for him. So from St. Louis, we went to Haverhill, Massachusetts. He was rabbi there, and then Providence, Rhode Island, invited him to become the community rabbi, which he did. And later on, in the 1941, he became the dean of the Orthodox Rabbinate of Philadelphia. I came to Pittsburgh in 1942. Actually, I did not come to be here permanently as a rabbi. I was then a student at Columbia University, working for my master's degree in political philosophy and in history under Professor Saylo Baron. But they, Shara Torah, that is, needed a rabbi for Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and Sukkot. So being that I could speak also Yiddish, and in 1942 there was a preponderance of Yiddish-speaking members in the Shara Torah on Townsend Street. And at Yeshiva University, there were very few students who could speak Yiddish. They were mostly American-born, Native American. So I was recommended for this position. And then, although I came on a temporary basis, I was invited to remain as on a permanent basis to take the position of the late Rabbi Zibitz, who was an internationally known rabbinic scholar and leader. And this was a frightening challenge to me, because Rabbi Zibitz was not only a great scholar, he left over some 19 volumes of scholarly work, which was internationally recognized, but he was a very, very revered and venerated rabbinic personality throughout the Jewish world. And to me, it was a frightening thing to step in the boots of such a personality. Still and all, I did accept the position because there was an opportunity, there were two opportunities here. First of all, to build a synagogue on that pattern which I wanted to build. I felt that here I could fashion something, not the way it was handed to me, but the way I would like to see it. Because I did feel that new generations have new challenges and they have new needs. Rabbi Zibitz might have been a great rabbi, but his conditions and the requirements of his age were not the requirements of my age. And this was one incentive. Another incentive was that I could continue my graduate work, in which I was very much interested, at the graduate school of the University of Pittsburgh, which, of course, admitted me, and where I was given an opportunity to finish my work for my doctorate, where I did finish it. And then I started building almost single-handedly the new synagogue in Squirrel Hill. When we started building the synagogue, when we acquired this piece of land, we had in the bank only $6,500. This edifice in which you sit now is valued at $1,250,000 right now, this piece of real estate here. So you probably have questions, and I think I was talking too much and too fast, and you didn't have an opportunity to ask.
Well, all right, we'll stop and ask a few questions.
I have one, right, just a very specific one. This Dr. Rosen from the JDC.
Dr. Joseph Rosen.
And where was he from? Was he a Russian?
He was originally from Russia, and this when he came to the United States and he studied, but because he knew Russia and he was very much aware and he knew the background, therefore the JDC felt that he would be the man to represent them there. Without the language and without the culture, and if you don't know the environment, you couldn't do much in the Soviet Union.
Many questions crossed my mind as you were talking, and I was so fascinated that I didn't even make notes of them. But when you said that you were traveling, you must have made previous arrangements long before you undertook this trip, when you met the boat, for example.
Oh, this was my mother's.
Your mother had arranged
it? Exactly, certainly.
And also,
it was very secretly, and when the boat was arranged, it was told only that we're going to this city, to Vitebsk, nothing else.
What the body of water you said you were on?
Oh, the Dvina. D-V-I-N-A. It's a well-known river in the Soviet Union.
River.
Almost as well-known as the Mississippi or the Missouri here.
It's a very large, very long river, evidently.
Sure. It falls in into the Baltic.
How old were you at the time?
When this thing happened, I'll tell you exactly. This was in 1932, right.
Said.
And I was born in 1918. So here you have it. It's 14 years old.
You were 14, imagine.
Yeah, but I remember it, though.
Well, of course.
As if it happened yesterday.
Your brothers that were at the Yeshiva in Poland, were they older than you at that
yes.
point?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I was number five in the family.
Number five.
Yes.
And they're all, are they all...
No, two of them, unfortunately, I lost.
You lost.
They came here. They served in the rabbinate. One of them was a very prominent rabbi in Philadelphia, left over four scholarly volumes, and his son is a very prominent doctor in Connecticut, now an only child that he left. And my other brother, Rabbi Abraham, he was also a rabbi in Philadelphia, but he passed away at the age of 52. Reuben passed away at the age of 33.
Mm-hmm.
And the one who passed away at the age of 52, he left over five children. Both sons are rabbis, and the three son-in-laws are rabbis. And two of them are very prominent, and he left over girls, I mean daughters, who studied at Stern College. And they're well known for their scholarly work of their own. I could show you tradition, the scholarly journal of the Rabbinical Council of America. And there's Dr. Hannah Pupko, his daughter-in-law, who writes a very important scholarly paper on this. But unfortunately, he passed away at the time. And my other brothers are in the rabbinate in the United States and in Israel.
Israel.
Yes,
one is in Israel.
You have a daughter who is married and lives in Israel,
isn't that so?
Yeah. Is she married to a rabbi too?
Oh, yes. Not only a rabbi, he's a professor of Talmud in Jerusalem, and he's a well-known rabbinic author. He authored already two books, and he publishes very frequently in the rabbinic scholarly journals. Here I have about six or eight of his articles in Israeli rabbinic journals, his work, and also in American scholarly journals. And she's working for her graduate degree at Hebrew University, and she teaches in a girls' college in Jerusalem. And they have two children.
I think I met her, didn't I?
Yes,
with,
sure, sure.
When my son had a party.
Right, right, yeah. Right. She was
here.
Yes.
Rabbi, can you tell us how many living rabbis there are in your family right now?
Well, it depends. If you will say family, nephews and uncles and cousins, the entire Pupko branch, branching out on both sides and all around, with speak conservatively, I would say we have at least on Ein Hora over 200 serving in the rabbinate in Europe, the United States, Latin America, and Israel.
Huh. It's fabulous, isn't it?
Well, I'll show you in our own immediate family.
Yes.
In our own immediate family. My mother, God bless her, is about 85. In fact, I spoke to her on the phone just an hour ago. She has 19 grandsons ordained rabbis. 19 grandsons, and there are many younger ones who are stepping into yeshivas or are in yeshivas now studying. So I'm giving you an example, and she, Kananore, has grandchildren about 35, and together with great grandchildren, I think she has 48. so you can see, and the almost all of them are exposed to a Jewish, an intensive Jewish education. This is the tradition in the family. Mm-hmm. Whether they remain in the occupation or not, but they have to be educated enough Jewishly to be ordained.
And they're all in the Orthodox orientation?
Well, I have already several cousins, I have to tell you the truth, who are also in the conservative brotherhood. Several, I would say about three or four.
Well, that's not very many.
Yeah.
Because I know that the Orthodoxy is something that you maintain very strictly, and you stand for very staunchly.
We try.
I know that. I'm wondering if we can hear Rabbi Pupko's voice on the tape for a minute, just to make sure that we're catching everything. Would you mind?
Am I too far?
No, you're not too far. I just feel that these are so important, the things you're telling us, and it's almost impossible to get down all of the things.
Okay.
I have two sisters. One is my twin sister, and she is married to Rabbi Mordechai Savitsky of Boston. He authored the commentary upon the Babylonian Talmud, and he is an internationally known expert of the Talmud and Jewish law. In fact, his first book on rabbinics he published when he was 17 years old in Poland, and this was quite an event. My younger sister is married to Rabbi Schwartz, also a well-known rabbinic scholar. He's rabbi of the Young Israel in Brooklyn, in Borough Park, and he's third generation born in the United States. Third generation born here, and he authored two books on rabbinics.
Would you spell your twin husband?
Yes, Rabbi Mordechai Savitsky, S-A-V-I-T-S-K-Y.
Okay.
Savitsky, I think. Here, just somebody brought me a newspaper where there was an article on this. This is
is that his picture?
He doesn't look like a Reform rabbi, nor not even like the modern Orthodox rabbi.
He is a Reform rabbi?
No.
That my question.
This is an article about one of his latest books. There is a review and there is a write-up on it.
Well, I'm not going to take your time.
No, that's all right.
Yes, we would like some of the things that you can spare to put with your material later, if you have.
I can get it together, and I'm more than happy to give you.
Yes, that's fine.
I have a tremendous reservoir of those collection.
And a photograph, perhaps, of you.
We can get it for you.
Yes, that would be lovely for us to have.
Yeah.
And it's very desirable in the case of a person like yourself.
Now, our oldest son, Joel, served during the last 5 years as Nebrit Hillel Rabbi at the University of Michigan. Mm-hmm. And now he was promoted to be the Nebrit Hillel Director for a full region, that is for Chicago and the neighboring cities. So they just moved last week to Chicago, and there he will be directing the work of some 19 or 20 rabbis on university campuses. And he has written extensively, especially for the Bnei Brit Monthly Journal and others in Europe, on the Holocaust. He's considered an authority on the Holocaust. They sent him on a fellowship 3 times to Poland to study the concentration camps. And in fact, Eli Wiesel refers to him as a serious student of the Holocaust. And he has been traveling and lecturing extensively on the campuses on the Holocaust. And our second son, Jacob Moses, is the associate dean of the Rabbinical College of Florida, which is in Miami. He's serving in this position now, his third year. And our two youngest children are twins, Reuben and Rebecca. And Rebecca is a graduate of the Hillel Academy, and she was just now accepted to the Girls' College of Jerusalem, where she will study this coming year. And Reuben is studying in a rabbinical college. So that takes care of the family.
Yes, it.
And of course, we have grandchildren.
Have you? Many?
Yes, not many. We have only five.
Well, I think you're doing very well.
Yeah.
For the Jewish perpetration of the Jewish population at its highest level.
We try.
That's great. The next question that we have, and you've almost conveyed to us in some way, is your home, your atmosphere, the religious the atmosphere of your home, which is very obvious.
I should have mentioned that my mother is a Talmudic scholar in her own right. She's the only woman mentioned in the Who is Who in the World Rabbinate, which was published in Vilna some 52 years ago. They write about her that she knew so much Talmud when she was 13 that she gave lessons to other students. Those days it was extremely rare that a girl should be, God bless you, should be, let this be on the record, that a girl should be exposed to higher Jewish education. And in fact, my mother was one of the principal speakers here in 1943 when I was installed at the Shara Torah as the rabbi. And later on, she lectured quite a few times here and in other synagogues in Petersburg. She used to be a frequent guest speaker in other communities.
Does your mother, does she go under the name of Mrs.?
Yes, Mrs. Pupko.
What is the first name?
Pesha Chaya, Mrs. Pesha Chaya.
Pesha, that's my name,
isn't it? Yes, fine. E-S-H-A.
Chaya.
Chaya.
Chaya,
C-H-A-Y-A, Chaya. Pesha Chaya. Her father was the chief rabbi, the famous chief rabbi of Saratov. Saratov is a large city in the Soviet Union with a university, Saratov.
I have to stop to get my breath. I'm so overwhelmed with all of this. They're asking about the atmosphere, the religious atmosphere in your home, which is very obvious.
Well, I do want to mention something. Yes. I was brought up in an atheistic country. I went to a school which fought religion. When I came into school, I saw on the wall the slogan, "Religion is the opiate of the people." I was forced, physically and otherwise, to attend school on the Sabbath and on the holiday. Otherwise, my parents would have been arrested. And when I went to school, we are called the Stalin children, who were exposed to the most brutal humiliation. If you were the child of a rabbi, or a priest, or of a merchant, or of a manufacturer, anyone in those brackets, they were non-persons, and they were non-citizens. They were not given citizens' rights. And when there was famine and starvation, and most of our life was spent in famine and starvation in Russia, when you had to stay in line, I personally stood in line sometimes 8 hours to get a pound of dry bread, like a piece of brick. But you could get it only if you had a card, a ration card. We could not get a ration card to get our food. And we had to get it through other means, in a black market. It was a struggle of existence. I, for example, until we came into Latvia, I never saw white bread. I didn't know that there is such a thing as white bread. Or we did not know what is sugar. We used saccharin. Sugar was totally, you could not get it. And so far, but still we survived. Now, we had to go to the synagogue secretly. Our parents would wake us up about 5 in the morning. And we would go to the synagogue when nobody would see us go into the synagogue. We had to receive our Hebrew religious education secretly. Our melamed, our teacher, had a cheder, He used to take us in a basement, under a basement. And his wife would always watch whether police are around or not. And then he would hide us still in another room if somebody came to look, because it was against the law. Mm-hmm. Now, too, it is against the law to teach children religion. You're not permitted to do it. And then it was very, very strict. And under these conditions, we had to acquire and to master how to read Hebrew, how to pray, Bible, Talmud, whatever it was. It was a very trying thing. And if you came to school on Saturday,